va peut-être commencer. Donc, comme je le disais, aujourd'hui, on a un très grand expert de la biologie de l'évolution, qui est le professeur Nick Barton, qui a commencé sa carrière à Londres. Après, il a passé une vingtaine d'années à Édimbourg. Et maintenant, depuis 12 ans, je crois, il est en Autriche. Et donc, il a reçu de très nombreuses récompenses. Et je suis très heureux qu'il ait accepté de venir parler ici de modèles d'évolution de manière sûrement beaucoup plus savante et que experte que moi. Et je lui donne la parole maintenant.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you to Bernard and also to Collège de France. I should start by apologizing that I'm having to speak in English rather than French. It would sound much better in French, I'm sure. But, I also should apologize for giving a really very ambitious talk, which covers actually a lot of what is going on in evolutionary genetics at the moment. What I'll do really is try and give some of the biological context to the things.
Okay. To try and give some of the biological context to the things that Bernard was talking about in his first lecture and in some of the previous lectures, I'll give really a talk in three parts. I'll start. Is this working? Yes. I'll start by talking about how I got interested in evolutionary genetics, working on what are called hybrid zones, sharp boundaries between distinct populations. And I'll then explain how the field has changed since I started working 40 or more years ago, so that now we think not in terms of the frequencies of different types, the frequencies of different alleles in a population. Instead, we think in terms of genealogies, the ancestral relationships between genes which are inferred from DNA sequence. And so there's really been a really big shift in the field from the days when I started, where there was a very elaborate theory, but cast in terms of gene frequencies. And that shifted to a very different way of looking at things now that we have abundant sequence data. I should maybe also say that it's a rather embarrassing time for particularly a theorist, because back, let's say, 30 years ago, just before DNA sequence data was becoming abundant and cheap and widely available, we had quite a mature theory. We had an elaborate mathematical theory, but we had almost no data to test it with. And we would say, well, if we had enough data, then we could tell you about the history of the population, we could tell you about the strength of selection, we could infer all kinds of things, we could answer all kinds of questions, but we didn't have enough data. Now we have all the data we could want, more than we could have imagined 30 years ago. And embarrassingly, it turns out these questions are not so easy to answer, and I'll try and give you an inkling of why things are very complicated. At least I can achieve that. So I'll talk firstly about hybrid zones, my early work, and then talk about how we think of populations in terms of genealogies, and then at the end bring this together by talking about a particular example, work with Alison Etheridge in Oxford, Amandine Weber at Ecole Polytechnique, on what happens when a favourable mutation occurs, increases in the population, sweeps through a population. How does that distort the genealogies, the ancestral relationships at other genes in the genome? And therefore, how can we use patterns of genetic variation to infer the presence and the action and the nature of these kinds of selective sweeps? So this example will be quite a complicated one, but it'll be one that will at least give you an idea of the problems that we see when we try and understand the effect of spatial structure and selection on genealogies. So going back to 1976, when I started a PhD with Godfrey Hewitt in University of East Anglia in Norwich, and I have to admit that I got into all this, having had a training in genetics, I got into this because I was really attracted by a project doing fieldwork in the Alpes Maritimes. And indeed, it was really a very wonderful system. So I started working on this little grasshopper, Podisma pedestris. Very nice to work with. It has an annual life cycle. The males here are very brightly coloured. The females, also quite easy to find, not quite so bright. But they're pedestrian. They don't fly, which meant I could catch them. They have an annual life cycle. They're quite abundant, so one can sample them. The reason we studied them is that Godfrey Hewitt had found a remarkable transition between two different types. The grasshoppers look the same everywhere, basically, but they have two different chromosome arrangements. In most of their range, they have a single X in the male and two X's in the female, rather like our sex chromosome system. And then they have 11 other pairs of chromosomes. And that's a fairly standard arrangement for grasshoppers. But in the southern French Alpes-Maritimes, south of the French-Italian border, more or less, there's an arrangement here. This is showing the chromosomes paired up at meiosis in males. This will be made from male testes. And you see that the sex chromosome, this blob here, is joined onto one of the other chromosomes, and it's paired up in the usual way with its homologous chromosome. So instead of having an X in the male and then the 11 pairs, there's now 10 pairs plus one of these fused chromosomes. It's a fusion between two chromosomes. It actually behaves in a very simple way and is inherited as a sex-linked Mendelian trait. Actually, the details of the chromosome mechanics aren't too important here. It's actually simply a very easily scorable trait. This was in the days before molecular work was cheap and easy, and it was very nice to be able to go out into the field and take a microscope and be able to see, you know, day to day exactly where we were in this transition zone. So mapping it out, it stretches for about 100 kilometres this way, but is only about a kilometre wide. And when we look at one of the transitions, let's say here, l'école de Tonde, we see 100% of the fused type, 100% of the unfused type, and a smooth transition represented here. Each dot is a sample of 20 male grasshoppers. So you see a lot of noise, it's mostly sampling error, but a smooth transition on average. So how do we explain this kind of sharp boundary? Well, it's fairly straightforward to explain this, and the model was suggested originally by Bazykin, a Russian geneticist, in 69, and it's a reaction diffusion model, which I think some of you have heard about before. We have one term which describes the diffusion of gene frequency. P here is the frequency of, let's say, the fused chromosome type. P is a function of position x and time t, and it changes primarily by diffusion. We can measure the rate of diffusion. This sigma squared is the variance of the distance between the parent and the offspring. For these grasshoppers, sigma is about 20 meters in a generation. And then we have another term here, which represents the effect of selection. And the selection that we believe is acting on these kind of chromosome arrangements is simply that the females who are heterozygous, that is, have a fused chromosome trying to pair up with two unfused, that is an arrangement that would look like that, that here there are three things which pair up, and they pair up perfectly fine. And usually, in meiosis, the process that produces the eggs, that process usually works, and we get these two chromosomes going this way, one going this way, but you've still got three things trying to go in two directions, and this goes wrong sometimes. And that means that individuals that have identical chromosome pairs pairing up are fine, but those that are, as we say, heterozygous, that have two distinct types pairing up, different chromosome arrangements pairing, they suffer a certain degree of sterility, let's say S. And the rate of change of gene frequency due to this selection against the heterozygotes is this second term, and it looks something like that. And intuitively, it's fairly obvious that this will give you two stable equilibria. You can have this chromosome type or that chromosome type. There's an unstable equilibrium in the middle separating the two. So whichever type is commoner will tend to fix in the population. And this is actually a very common pattern. Many, many mammal species, for example, across Europe, are divided into a mosaic of regions with a different chromosome arrangement. Okay, so this pattern of chromosome variation, separation by very narrow hybrid zones, is very common. And in this case, we have a simple equation. We predict a transition, sigmoid transition, with a width, which depends on a balance between diffusion rate and selection rate. And in this case, we can measure the width. It's about 800 meters. We can measure the dispersal just by marking the grasshoppers and seeing how far they go. And you estimate that the selection coefficient needed to explain this is actually quite weak, about 0.5%. And that's typical of these situations. Even though they're very strikingly narrow boundaries relative to the range of the species, hundreds of kilometers, the actual selection needed to maintain them is not that great, partly because, of course, the grasshoppers are not going very far. But in general, one doesn't have to invoke very drastic processes. It's actually slightly frustrating because this selection of about 0.5% is really too weak to measure. I spent a lot of time looking down the microscope trying to estimate selection on heterozygotes by looking at how often the chromosome disjunction went wrong, and I showed that it was less than 1%. But, you know, it's really not... Well, I didn't have the energy, let's say, or the stamina to really measure this very, very weak selection. Okay, so these sorts of situations raise all kinds of questions. We can ask, why is it that this boundary lies where it is? Why isn't it an absolutely straight line? What is it that's pinning it to a particular position? What happens if, as we know there are in the grasshoppers, and there are in most situations, what happens if many different genes are involved? How do they interact? What is the effect of random fluctuations? If we go back here, this noise is not just sampling error. About half of it is sampling error. The other half is real fluctuation, and we can infer things about the rate of dispersal and the rate of random drift, the population density, from these patterns. So there's interesting information there. One of the hardest questions, and actually essentially unanswered for these systems, is how does the new type establish? If we say that the rare type is always at a disadvantage, how does it ever get to high frequency? And a lot of these questions are related to questions relating to speciation. One can see these situations as models for an early stage in the process of divergence that will eventually lead to new species. But actually, my main interest in these situations has been that hybrid zones allow us to have a kind of natural laboratory where instead of having to go to a lot of trouble and expense to breed organisms and make genetic crosses in the lab, nature has done that for us and has tested various gene combinations in natural conditions so that we can make estimates of selection, rates of diffusion, numbers of genes involved, and so on, just by taking observations from the field. So this is very attractive. One can do field work for a couple of months and get a lot of useful data and infer things that would not be measurable directly. And I've worked on, you know, quite a lot of different systems. Hybrid zones are actually very common. Perhaps most species are divided into a mosaic of patches separated by narrow boundaries. One of the most striking and well-known examples, well-studied examples, is Heliconius, a group of butterflies found in Central and South America. These are toxic. They advertise their distastefulness to birds by having a bright warning pattern. And in any one area, many butterflies and many species share the same pattern. But in different areas, they have different patterns, whole diversity. And there's a narrow boundary between each of these patterns, typically a few kilometers across. And the width of that boundary tells us about the strength of selection, favoring the common warning pattern. Rare types are at a disadvantage because birds don't recognize them as being distasteful and they tend to get eaten. The bird learns, but it's too late for the butterfly. Another system I've worked on are fire-bellied toads, which are used to be common across Europe. They've now dwindled in numbers, sadly. But they form two very different species, Bombina bombina, the fire-bellied toad, Bombina variegata, the yellow-bellied toad. They differ in colour pattern. You can recognise individuals by their pattern, which is quite convenient. But they differ in many other ways. They're adapted to different habitats. These live in upland puddles, temporary habitats. These live in large, permanent lowland ponds. And you find all the way around the edge of the Danube Basin, where these habitats meet, you find a narrow boundary about 6 kilometres wide separating the two. So these are very different systems. These Heliconius butterflies are actually rather similar to each other genetically. These Bombina toads are very different genetically, but they have similar processes involved in separating the two types. I'm now working on snapdragons, Antirrhinum, which are common garden plants but live in the wild in Spain, and they have various different colour forms, subspecies yellow versus magenta, differing mostly in the genetics determining flower colour. And in this valley near Andorra, we find as you go from one end to the other over a few kilometres, you find a transition from here to here with a mixture of different colours. And we're studying these for a number of reasons. One is they have a small genome, they have very good genetics, so we can do much more kind of modern genetics on them. The toads and grasshoppers had nightmarishly huge genomes, so they're very hard to work with. But also these Antirrhinum have, you know, very large, obvious flowers, and one can attempt a more or less complete sampling of the population and follow relationships of individuals over the years. So that's my current system. Surprisingly, all this stuff, which I thought was completely abstract and entirely useless, turns out to have an application. I've been working with Michael Toretti as part of a large project funded by the Gates Foundation to control dengue fever. And this is a rather strange and really quite interesting story. Wolbachia are bacteria that infect many, many species of insects. And these bacteria are transmitted from mother to offspring. They're transmitted maternally. And they slightly reduce, at least in the mosquitoes we're studying, they slightly reduce the female fertility. So they have a disadvantage. So why do they spread? Well, many species of Wolbachia have an extraordinary mechanism for increasing in the population. And the way they do that is that infected males do not pass on the infection, but the infected males, when they mate with an uninfected female, sterilize that female. So when the infection is rare, this has rather little effect, but when the infection is common, the infected males will sterilize almost all of the uninfected females. And so there's a big advantage above a threshold. And so there's a dynamic which is rather like the dynamics of the chromosome arrangement, but with a threshold frequency which is actually set by the selective disadvantage in female fecundity. It's about 20% in the mosquitoes we're looking at. So the original idea was, you know, seemed reasonable if you didn't think about it too much, and that was to introduce a quite strong strain of Wolbachia into Aedes aegypti, which transmits many diseases. And the idea was it would reduce the lifespan of the mosquito and therefore reduce transmission. But the problem is that in order to reduce lifespan enough to have a significant effect, the threshold frequency is pushed above 50%, and that means that the infection can't spread in nature. So everyone was about to give up the project when it was discovered quite fortuitously, actually in Drosophila, that Wolbachia infection prevents viral transmission. So an insect infected with Wolbachia will be largely unable to transmit a variety of pathogens, including dengue and Zika and other arboviruses. And so then this gave a different way of looking at the problem, and actually a much more effective way, that one can introduce a rather mild strain, mild in the sense that it doesn't reduce female fecundity very much, and establish it in a population and suppress dengue transmission. And this really seems to work. So our rather small contribution to this was to apply the sorts of reaction diffusion models to understand the actual spread of this after an artificial establishment, and to ask how big an area needs to be established in order to get this to spread. How quickly will it spread? It turns out not very quickly, because mosquitoes don't disperse very much normally. And what's the optimal distribution? Should one introduce a lot in a small area or a smaller fraction in a large area for a given cost? What's the optimal introduction protocol? So that was our modelling approach. And actually, amazingly, it seems to be working that in northern Australia, where this started, basically dengue transmission seems to have been suppressed. The infection has been established throughout the areas where dengue was a problem. And it's now being trialled throughout Asia, and actually also in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro. The biggest experimental trial has been in Indonesia, in this city of with an area here covered about 65,000 people, this area here. And the sort of dark brown areas are experimental trial releases, and the light brown are control areas. So it's a randomized trial. They actually threw a coin to say, you know, which areas were going to be subject to the release. And so we now have very nice data on the spread of the infection out here. And just very recently, actually got this just at the weekend, there's now data showing that before the release trial started, there was a, you know, very closely correlated fluctuation in dengue cases through the seasons, with a very close relationship between the frequencies in these control and experimental areas, as one would expect. But since the introduction, basically, this correlation has been broken, and there's very little, not quite zero, but almost zero infection in the treated areas. So this really seems to have been effective quite quickly. Okay. So that's the whole story about hybrid zones, largely a deterministic story, a story about reaction diffusion equations. I've ignored the sort of random component. But actually, it turns out that particularly with DNA sequence data, we can't ignore random fluctuations. And this is maybe, you know, not completely obvious, so I should spend a few minutes explaining why this is. Originally, all the work that I was talking about, all my sort of early work on hybrid zones, and most of population genetics, was tracking the frequencies of two types. P is the frequency of one type relative to another. So we track allele frequencies, and we have a whole lot of theory for explaining this. And then we have DNA sequence data, and this way of looking at things becomes quite inappropriate. Because when we take even a small chunk of DNA, a few thousand bases, each chunk that we take will be different. If I took, you know, any homologous section of DNA from any of you, lined them all up, we'd find that every sequence was different. At each of our each position in our genome, we carry two copies of each genome. And if we looked along the genome, roughly one in a thousand sites will be heterozygous, will show a difference. And up to 1%, depends how you calculate it, of sites will show some variation in the population. So that means that even a fairly short chunk of genome will have a huge amount of variability, and it doesn't make sense to count the frequencies of this type or that type. It's much more natural to try and infer the genealogy. We can almost observe the genealogy. And this is the natural way to think about sequence variation. So let's suppose we have four genomes that we sample, and I'll look at a small chunk of genome so that it stays intact during its inheritance, it doesn't recombine, let's say a few hundred bases. And we sample four chromosomes, it might be two individuals, each carrying two copies, whatever. And we might see a mutation here that's shared with A and B, we might see another mutation shared between C and D, and we might see a number of mutations that are just carried on, you know, one of the chromosomes. And so this tells us immediately that the relationships are something like this, because this mutation has to be ancestral to A and B, this mutation is ancestral to C and D, and then we have some other ones. Where have we got one there, which is just on B? Yeah. So by looking at the DNA sequences, we can work back and infer at least the topology of these genealogies. If we have enough sequence data, we can actually get an estimate of the length of these branches, because we expect that the number of mutations on this branch, say, let's say mutations like this, put another one in there, that number here, 2, is drawn from a Poisson distribution with an expectation equal to the length of that branch. In fact, if this branch spans T generations and the mutation rate is mu per chunk of genome per time, we expect, you know, to see mu times T mutations there with a Poisson distribution. So, of course, these estimates are rather rough, but they do give us, you know, remarkable information about genealogy. And crucially, in a sexual population such as ours, we have an enormous amount of such information, because each small chunk of genome has its own genealogy. If we look at a different chunk of genome, it'll have a different pattern of inheritance, because as we trace back, some lineages come from the maternal chromosome, some from a different chromosome. So we have a single sexual pedigree, which Bernard introduced. You know, each individual has two parents and four grandparents and so on. We have this enormous sort of web, which is not a tree, it's a graph, a very, very interconnected web in which, as Bernard said, actually you only have to go back a few generations before everyone shares the same ancestry. But each gene in our genome, if you like, is taking a different path through this pedigree. And so as we look along the genome, we see a sample of literally millions and millions of different genealogies, which give us information about the whole history of the population. And so it's remarkable that even from just one individual, we can make inferences of how population size has changed through time as we go back into the past. And it's remarkable that we can make such estimates. I'm not quite sure how reliable they are. We can, in principle, make such estimates from just, you know, two genomes in a single diploid individual. Okay. So we now have to think about things in terms of genealogy. And this means that actually the process of random genetic drift really comes to the fore. And it's for two reasons, really. One is that when we look at the whole genome, whole DNA sequence, most of it, of course, is not, you know, determining fitness. We don't know what fraction of it does determine fitness. We really know very little about the distribution of effects of sites along the genome. But in the human genome, we have 3 × 10^9 base pairs. It can't all be important. Most of it is thought to be largely neutral. So we have to really start with this sort of neutral null model, which Bernard introduced as the coalescent process, which gives us a very beautiful and very precise and very very complete model of how evolution would look if there were no selection and if there were no spatial structure. So we have a good null model. But in this null model, you know, the random process is important, and the random process appears in the coalescent view of things as the process of coalescence. And if we trace back in time, the process of coalescence occurs because some individual had to leave two descendants. Other individuals, of course, which we don't see any trace of, left no descendants. And so if we think about things forwards in time, this process of coalescence is very closely related to the process by which some individuals leave more descendants and some leave fewer or no descendants. And in fact, the rate of coalescence going back in time is proportional to the variance in the number of gene copies left by a gene. If you imagined a sort of an ideal world in which every gene left a single copy, there will be no coalescence, and there will be no variation in allele frequency. Allele frequency would have to stay the same. You know, these two alleles would persist down these lineages and would stay at exactly the same frequency. So variation in offspring number drives both coalescence and random fluctuation in gene frequency. And these are actually, mathematically, the mirror images of each other. One is a process forwards in time, explaining how frequencies of different types in the population change. The other is a process backwards in time, explaining how genes come to share common ancestry. Okay, so the coalescent process gives us a complete model for generating neutral genealogies. And you've heard a lot about that in the previous lecture, and there are basically just two parameters we have to worry about. The genealogy itself is generated by this simple process where if you trace a pair of lineages back, they coalesce at a rate 1 over the effective number of genes in the population, 1 over 2n per generation. So there's a constant rate, the inverse of the population size, of coalescence. And what that means is that if we trace back, let's say, a large number of genes, there are many, many pairs with 100 genes. That's 100 times 99 over 2, whatever that is, 4,000 something or other. There's around 5,000 pairs. And so the rate of coalescence is very quick. And those pairs will coalesce down to just a few branches, which then trace back to the common ancestor. So this very simple model actually produces a non-trivial and quite intriguing model, you know, which we can use to describe many, many properties of the population. We don't see the genealogies, though. What we see are mutations. But provided that the mutations are neutral, they have no effect on reproduction, we can separate the process of coalescence, producing the genealogy, from the process of mutation. We can just throw mutations down onto the genealogy. We can assume that those mutations are unique. That's actually a good assumption because mutations are actually rather rare at any one site. It's unlikely that you'll see much variation. And so we just have another parameter, the rate of mutation per site, per generation, which determines the pattern of mutations we see. And we can work back from the mutations, the genealogies, to the underlying parameters that generated the process. So if the world were utterly boring, then we would have a very simple task, theoretically. The problem is that we have population structure, that is, genes are not in a single well-mixed population, they come from different places. They may be structured into different subpopulations in all kinds of ways. But also there's selection, meaning that actually some mutations do affect fitness and do affect the reproduction. And that's actually a very hard problem to integrate with the coalescent framework. So that's what we'll be coming to. And what I'll do is describe this work in this paper, which really actually tries to combine the effect of space and the effect of population structure. So I'll only be giving a sort of very rough outline of what we do, more or less a pictorial description. And hopefully I'll at least achieve my main goal, which is to show you it's all very complicated, but maybe not too complicated. Okay. Ah. No. Okay. So the situation we're thinking of is a very large population spread initially along one dimension, and a mutation arises, and it has advantage S in these simulations, an advantage 1%, and one could show with a simple branching process argument that its probability of actually getting established in the population is 2S, 2%, let's say it gets established, and then it will diffuse out and spread out and start travelling in a travelling wave, and I think you've heard about the Fisher equation, which describes this travelling wave, diffusion term, plus a selection term. And unlike the selection term I talked about before, where there were two stable states, we now just have one favoured allele, and the selection term is actually SP, 1 minus P, generating a wave which travels forward at a steady speed. And the speed is actually the square root of the diffusion rate times the selection coefficient. So we can work out what that is, and this all works rather well. So on this diagram, drawn distance here, time along here, and the black represents the new advantageous type. So, see, we start out here with only the old type, which is in white, and then the mutation occurs, and it starts to spread out, and the as time goes on, the area occupied by the new type increases linearly. So this straight line represents the speed of advance of this Fisher wave. And the grey here is sort of representation on the grayscale of the leading front of this, the region where the frequency of this new type is, let's say, 50%, you know, 10%, 1%, Okay. So this is the steady rate of advance. Now, what we're interested in is what happens to genealogies, which we can actually observe by sampling the population. And so we start out by thinking of these red lines, which are the ancestral lineages of genes sampled just behind the front here, and which are completely linked to this new mutation. So I'll try and maybe draw some picture of this. So I always get the axes wrong with this, but here we've got time in this direction and distance in this direction. So at this time, if we draw the little graph of the gene frequency, here's the sort of travelling front, it's moving in this direction, and we're sampling these genes, well, I can even do it with red. We sample some genes, let's say, just behind the front. So I sampled, I think, 30 genes and trace back their ancestral lineages. And if we go back a little bit earlier, then the front is a little bit further back, and these lineages, which had been just minding their own business, diffusing along, they actually get caught up in this wave, and they have to be tracing back to ancestors in the leading edge of this wave. And the reason is that these red lineages are completely linked to this favourable mutation. They have to trace back, ultimately, to that favourable mutation. They're inherited from that mutation. And so they diffuse about, just following a normal kind of random walk with a diffusion sigma squared, and then they hit this wave, going back in time, and they're sucked into the leading edge of the wave. And one can show, and this is the main part of the analysis, really, one can show that they actually trace back to individuals, to ancestors that are in a distribution here, which is right at the leading edge, so that actually, although this population is very large, in this simulation, there are 1,000 deans each of 10 to the 5 individuals, so we've got, say, 10 to the 8 individuals, an enormous population. So actually, it's very unlikely these genes will coalesce unless something happens. And this, what happens is this sweep, they're sucked back into this tiny ancestral population at the leading edge of the wave. And one can work out what that is, and it's, you know, of the order of a few hundred individuals for these parameters. And so now there's a very high rate of coalescence, and there are little blue dots here which show the rate of coalescence amongst these completely linked lineages, so that there's now quite rapid coalescence, and they actually trace back to a common ancestor to all 30 of those lineages, which is back there, about 3,000 generations back. And this is a dramatic event, because in a population of 10 to the 5 per deem times 1,000 deems, 10 to the 8, if the sweep hadn't happened, the time to common ancestry would be of the order of 10 to the 8 generations, or 2 times 10 to the 8. And now it's only the order of 10 to the 3. So this is drastically reduced diversity. So then we go out a bit and we ask, what happens at a gene which is slightly further away, which recombines at a rate 10 to the minus 4? And that's this orange, I think, these orange lineages. Well, they get swept back in the same way, but they have a chance of escape. They have a rate of escape, 10 to minus 4. And so they're trapped in this little ancestral population, but they can get out of it by recombination. If that happens faster than coalescence, then they trace back, and they trace back through the ancestral population many, many generations, actually 10 to the 8 generations. The purple lineages are a bit further away, and they have a higher rate of escape, etc., etc. So actually, we can get a pretty complete picture of this by thinking in terms of what's called a structured coalescent. So these kind of models are models where we have the coalescent process, but they're structured by, in this case, being in this genetic background or that genetic background, and by being in this location and that location. And the rule is very simple. If you're in different places, you can't coalesce. If you're in different genetic backgrounds, you can't coalesce. You can get from one place to another by migrating. You can get from one background to another by recombining. And once you're in the same place, in the same background, then you can coalesce. So the rate of coalescence is drastically reduced by this structure. So this actually is a very powerful method, and it's been used to get a lot of results rather like this. I should say that it has a limitation. And the limitation is that we have to assume that selection is much stronger than drift. So we can treat this forwards process as absolutely known deterministic, which is not quite true, but it's a good approximation in this case. In this case, in one dimension. Okay. So if we go on and we stand back and we say, well, look, what if this is happening all the time in the population? What if there are lots of selective sweeps happening? So now I've for some reason rotated it, so we now have distance along here, we have time here, and this is the usual way to draw trees. And we imagine that at various times and locations in the past, these red dots, a favorable mutation got established, and these orange lines show how it spreads out at a certain speed. And so this is a simulation. I should say a real simulation, does that make sense? Anyway, some sort of, yes, with real parameters, so that the shallower lines mean a less advantageous allele that spreads more slowly. The steeper lines have a stronger selective advantage. Okay, so these are these selective sweeps. So each one of those has an effect like the one in the previous picture. And then we trace back three lineages, a blue, a black, and a purple. And we trace them back, and this one goes back, and it then is hit by this sweep, and it has to the extent that it's linked to this mutation, it has to be pulled back, and if it was completely linked, it would be pulled back to that mutation. But we assume some recombination, and so it can escape. So it's pulled back and escapes, and then it's hit by another one, and it escapes and goes back to there. And actually, in this picture, with these parameters, mostly what happens is that these lineages are knocked left and right, so that actually most of the dispersal, if you add it up, is due to these selective sweeps, not due to the random process of just diffusion. But there is one coalescence event, I think, where the blue and the purple coalesce in this black line, sorry, black and purple in this black line. This is where they were both pulled back to this, near this ancestral mutation, and then coalesced. So we've gone from 3 down to 2, so there's been both a loss of diversity and an increase in dispersal, in diffusion. And in fact, depending on the parameters, one of those can be important, or the other can be important, or both can be important. And the task that we have, which is actually a very challenging task in real data, is to try and, you know, infer the parameters of these kind of processes. Now, if we believe this model, then that's not too bad. We have, you know, two or three parameters to estimate, and we have a lot of sequence data, so we can do this. The difficulty is we don't actually know what's going on, and all we have are rather general patterns. For example, that regions of lower recombination show lower diversity, and this is a key observation in the field, which shows that there is some effect of linkage. There's some effect of selection at linked loci, which means if there's less recombination, there's these hitchhiking effects reduce diversity. That's very well established. But we don't know what kind of selection, and it turns out to be very hard to estimate even how much selection there is in aggregate. So it remains an open question just how important this kind of stuff is in understanding real data. And I'll just finish by mentioning an open question, which is, what if the world were two-dimensional? I'm not even going to go to three dimensions, but, you know, for biology, two dimensions is much more realistic than one dimension for most cases. And so, you know, we do the same thing. Now, immediately, the simulations become much more of a nightmare because we have to simulate in two dimensions many more individuals. But this is just a simulation where I had 200 deems on a cylinder. This is in the y direction, and 500 deems on the x direction. This shows a kind of snapshot where the front has started at time zero, and after 4,000 generations, it's reached there. And what we do is take the genes here, and we take a subset of the genes. There are an enormous number of genes, a million per deem, so it's a huge population. But we just take a set of those as kind of markers. We colour them in. There's red up here and blue down there. They've all got a different colour. And we trace them back and we ask two questions. One is, where do two genes that we take from the same deem, when do they come back together in the same deem? So we take these two genes. They mostly diffuse away. And then they'll come back at some point, and that's a small dot. So a red gene here will be represented by a red dot whenever the two genes come together. There might be several red dots. But when two genes that start in the same deem come together and coalesce, we get a big red dot. So every big red dot is a loss of variation. So when I started doing this, I had the naive and foolish idea that it would all be simple, that we could just take the previous analysis and assume that the genes were diffusing up and down in this transverse direction in a very boring way. And that's not at all what happens. You can see that the ancestry gets sucked into really three paths, more or less, this sort of path here, this path here, this path here. And so the genes here are actually moving much further in the transverse direction than you might expect from diffusion. And that's because what's happening is that here there was an individual or a few individuals that got ahead of the wave front, and they had very high reproductive success and therefore left many descendants. So all of these go back to these. All of these go back to these. So there's a huge amount of hitchhiking going on, much more in a way. It's a much more stochastic picture in 2D than in 1D. And so we're sort of currently working, and actually many other people are working on this kind of problem, trying to understand how we can represent the effects of selection sweeping through in two dimensions with two-dimensional space, and what is the effect of that on the genealogies we observe. So lots of interesting, both mathematical and sort of empirical questions there. So I'll finish up now. Summarising, I talked initially about hybrid zones and how one can actually get a very, now it seems, having got involved in all these nightmarishly complicated problems, now it seems a wonderful, easy time when everything was deterministic, you do a reaction diffusion, you fit the data, it all works quite well. But now we're suffering this abundance of DNA sequence data where we really have to think in terms of genealogies, we have to think in terms of a neutral null model, which is based on the coalescent process. Again, this is a really beautiful model as long as we don't complicate it by introducing space and selection. And the problem we have is that actually we can solve, you know, specific problems with spatial structure, with selection. We can get a long way with these. But in reality, we have a heap of sequence data and we don't know what the appropriate model is. And we don't even know in principle how far we can go in really understanding our history, history of our population and of other species, and how we can understand where selection is acting along the genome. So plenty of work to do. Thank you.
Il y a des questions.
If we go back to these hybrid zones, what is pinning them?
What is pinning them? Ah, okay. So I actually did too much work on this in the in the French grasshoppers and the Alpine grasshoppers, because you could actually walk up and down and count them until you could measure density. And the sort of theoretical argument is that they'll tend to move to areas that minimise density and dispersal. And you can write down a potential function, which is actually the integral of density squared times dispersal along this front. And you can actually, if you know the density and dispersal, which is rather hard to measure, but we can sort of guess, if you know that, you can predict where it should go. And we did two cases where we could really predict it. If you stand back, it's kind of obvious that they go along the ridge of the French Alps. And what happened was that, you know, one population expanded after the ice melted 10,000 years ago, another population expanded, they met. It's kind of obvious that's where they'll meet. Where they go in detail is not so obvious, and our hypothesis is that it's determined by minimising this potential function. But of course, proving that, it's unfortunately, it's not physics, so we can't measure anything really well enough to really be sure about that. I should say, going back to the Wolbachia biocontrol, this is a practical issue, because these infections spread until they get to a highway, and it turns out mosquitoes don't like crossing roads. And one of the things coming out of the Indonesia experiment is that we can measure the rate of diffusion across small roads, medium roads, and big roads. And actually, you know, then we have practical calculations of what's the probability that the mosquitoes will actually get across and spread.
Est-ce qu'il y a des questions? Okay, so I have some questions, but first, we had a talk a few weeks ago by a mathematician from Toulouse who showed that the spread of mosquitoes was favored along roads also, because it was not, this is just the inverse of
what, the opposite of what it
takes,
okay.
It takes time to cross, but they say that they propagate through roads. But
so actually there's a distinction between short range dispersal, where mostly, you know, the distribution of mosquito dispersal, which is, you know, quite well understood, is really a matter of, you know, 50 metres, 100 metres. It's very short range. They stay where the blood is, I think, you know. But there are long range migrations. And there's a crucial difference, which you probably mentioned, between pushed and pulled waves. If it's a bistable system, then you have a pushed wave and it's the bulk dispersal that matters. Long range dispersal is irrelevant because long range dispersals are just selected out. If you have a pooled wave, then long-range dispersers can found a new propagule, and so the rate of spread then does depend on these long tails. So it may depend on what you're interested in. It may be true that if it's something that is spreading from low frequency as a pooled wave, then it's the rate of long-range propagation or long roads that matters. Yeah.
But did I understand well when you said that you take a single individual and you get the whole genealogy, or you get some information?
Yes, so this
by
is
comparing the two chromosomes?
The two genomes. This is a remarkable method which has become very widely used due to Richard Durbin, paper, I guess, 7 or 8 years ago now. So what they showed is, if you think about the coalescent process going back, the rate of coalescence is 1 over population size. And so if you could see the genealogy, and if you could actually then get a distribution of genealogies along the genome, you could estimate the rate of coalescence going back in time. And they showed how you can do this using a hidden Markov model by looking at patterns of variation along the genome. You see some chunks of genome which have high diversity, reflecting a very deep tree, and others reflecting a shallower tree. And by using this information about how diversity varies along the genome, they could estimate N of T, and actually fit a model where population size varies. And what happens is, if you take one of us, one of most of us, so someone of European descent, you get a relatively small recent population size, which drops, corresponding to a bottleneck when we came out of Africa, and then increases and then goes down. Take someone from Africa, then you get a larger recent population size, no bottleneck associated with out of Africa, because there wasn't such an event, but then Asians, Europeans, Africans all converge to the same estimates. So regardless of, you know, whether you really believe that this model is appropriate, it is estimating something which is consistent across different individuals. So.
Okay, so my last comment, but maybe we can discuss it privately, is that these large transversal fluctuations, you see, there are models that physicists have looked at for many years, like directed polymers, where you have transverse fluctuations which are much larger. I don't know whether they would apply.
Yes, now this would be interesting to follow up. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.